the first time they had come across such a phenomenon, and he calculated that the gig was correct. These ladders obviously led somewhere. He just hoped it was the factory. Haplo motioned the guide gigs, Jara and Limbeck to draw near him. Jara kept the numerous other gigs back with a wave of her hand. "What's up the ladder? How do we get into the factory?" "There was a hole in the floor," explained the gigs, "covered with a metal plate. Moving the plate allowed access to the main floor of the factory." "This factory is a huge place," said Haplo. "What part of it will I come up in? What part have they given over to the guard?" There was some lengthy discussion and argument over this. One gig had heard that the guard was in the manger's room two floors up over the main floor of the factory. The other gig had heard that the guard was, by orders of the high foreman, being kept in the board room. "What's that?" Haplo asked patiently. "It's where my trial was held," said Limbeck, his face brightening at the memory of his moment of supreme importance. "There's a statue of a manger there, and the chair where the high foreman sits in judgment." "Where is this place from here?" The gigs thought it was about two more ladders down, and they all trooped in that direction, the two guide gigs arguing among themselves until Jara, with an embarrassed glance at Haplo, ordered them sharply to hold their tongues. "They think this is it," she said, placing her hand upon the ladder's steel rungs. Haplo nodded. "I'll go up first," he said as softly as he could and still make himself heard above the roar of the machine. The guide gigs protested. This was their adventure. They were leading. They should get to go up first. "There might be guards of the High Froman up there," said Haplo, "or this so-called guard might be dangerous." The gigs looked at each other, looked at Haplo, and backed away from the ladder. There was no further discussion. "But I want to see them," protested Limbeck, who was beginning to feel they'd come all his way for nothing. "Shh," remonstrated Haplo. "You will. I'm just going up to scout around, reconnoiter. I'll come back and get you when it is safe." "He's right, Limbeck, so be quiet," scolded Jara. "You'll have your chance soon enough. It would never do for the High Froman to arrest us before tonight's rally." Cautioning the need for quiet, at which all the gigs stared at him as if he were absolutely insane, Haplo turned to the ladder. "What should we do with the dog?" asked Jara. "He can't climb the ladder, and you can't carry him." Haplo shrugged, unconcerned. "He'll be all right, won't you, dog?" Leaning down, he patted the animal on the head. "You stay, dog, all right? Stay." The dog, mouth open and tongue lolling, plopped itself down on the floor and, ears cocked, looked around with interest. Haplo began his ascent, climbing the ladder slowly and carefully, allowing his eyes time to adjust to the increasing darkness as he moved out of the bright light of the glimmer lamps. The climb was not long. Soon he was able to see pinpoints of the glimmer lamp light below him, reflecting off a metal surface above. Reaching the plate, he put his hand on it and cautiously and gently pushed. It gave way smoothly and easily, and, he was thankful to note, quietly. Not that he was anticipating trouble. He wanted this chance to observe these gods without them observing him. Thinking regretfully that in the old days the threat, or the promise, of danger would have caused the dwarves to clamber up the ladders in droves, Haplo cursed the sartan beneath his breath, silently lifted the plate, and peered out. The glimmer lamps lit the factory brighter than a gig day. Haplo could see clearly, and he was pleased to note his guides had judged correctly. Directly in his line of vision stood a tall statue of a robed and hooded figure. Lounging around the statue were three people. They were human, two men and a child. That much Haplo could tell at a glance. But the sartan were also of human derivation. He inspected each one closely, though he was forced to admit to himself that he would not be able to tell simply by looking if these humans were sartan or not. One man sat beneath the statue in its shadow. Clad in plain clothing, he appeared to be of middle age, with thinning, receding hair that emphasized a domed, protruding forehead and a lined, careworn face. This man shifted restlessly, his gaze going worriedly to the child, and when he did so, Haplo saw that his movements, particularly of his hands and feet, were ungainly and awkward. By sharp contrast, the other adult human male present was one Haplo might have mistaken for a fellow survivor of the labyrinth. Lithe, well-muscled, there was an alert watchfulness about the man that, though he was lying relaxed, stretched out on the floor, smoking a pipe, indicated he kept instinctive, watchful vigil. The face, with its dark, deep crevices and twisted black beard, reflected a soul of cold, hard iron. The kid was a kid, nothing more, unless you counted a remarkable beauty. An odd trio. What brought them together? What brought them here? Down below, one of the overly excited gigs forgot the injunction to maintain silence, and shouted in what he apparently thought was a whisper to ask if Haplo could see anything. The man with the twisted beard reacted instantly, his body coiling swiftly to a standing position, his black eyes darting to the shadows, his hand closing over the hilt of the sword. Beneath him, Haplo heard a resounding smack, and knew that Jara had effectively punished the offender.
"What is it, you?"
asked the man sitting in the shadow of the statue. The voice spoke human, and it quavered with nervousness. The man addressed as Hugh put his fingers to his lips and crept several steps in the direction of Haplo. He did not look down, or he must have seen the plate, but was staring into the shadows. I thought I heard something.
"I don't know how you can hear anything over that racket that damn machine's making," stated the child. The boy was eating bread and staring up at the statue.
"Do not use such language, Your Highness," rebuked the nervous man. He had risen to his feet and seemed to have some idea of joining this Hugh in his search, but he tripped and only saved himself from a headlong fall by bracing himself against the statue.
"Do you see anything, sir?"
The Geggs, undoubtedly under threat of bodily harm from Jara, actually managed to keep quiet. Haplo froze, hardly daring to breathe, watching and listening intently.
"No," said Hugh. "Sit down, Alfred, before you kill yourself."
"It probably was the machine," said Alfred, looking as though he wanted very much to convince himself. The boy, bored, tossed his bread to the floor and walked over to stand directly in front of the statue of the Manger. He reached out to touch it.
"Don't!"
Alfred cried in alarm. The child, jumping, snatched his hand back.
"You frighten me," he said accusingly.
"I'm sorry, Your Highness. Just move away from the statue."
"Why? Will it hurt me?"
"No, Your Highness. It's just that the statue of the Manger is, well, sacred to the Geggs. They wouldn't like you bothering it."
"Phew," said the child, glancing around the factory. "They're all gone anyway. Besides, it seems like he wants to shake hands or something."
The boy giggled.
"The way he has his hands stuck out like that. He wants me to take it." "No, Your Highness!"
But the stumble-footed man was too late to prevent the boy reaching out and grasping hold of the Manger's mechanical hand. To the child's delight, the eyeball flickered with a bright light.
"Look!"
Bane shoved aside Alfred's frantic grasping hand.
"Don't stop it! It's showing pictures! I want to see!"
"Your Highness, I must insist. I know I heard something. The Geggs..." "I think we could handle the Geggs," said Hugh, coming over to look at the pictures. "Don't stop it, Alfred. I want to see what it's showing."
Taking advantage of the trio's preoccupation and feeling an intense interest in this statue himself, Haplo crept up out of the hole.
"Look, it's a map," cried the child, much excited.
The three were intent on the eyeball. Haplo, coming up silently behind, recognized the images flitting across the eye's surface as a map of the realm of the sky, a map remarkably like one his lord had discovered in the halls of the Sartan in the Nexus. At the very top were the isles known as Lords of Night. Beneath them, the firmament, and near them floated the Isle of the High Realm. Then came the Mid-Realm. Further down were the Maelstrom and the Land of the Geggs. Most remarkable, the map moved. The isles drifted around in their oblique orbits. The storm clouds swirled. The sun was periodically hidden by the Lords of Night. Then suddenly the images changed. The isles and continents ceased to orbit at random, and all lined up neatly in a row, each realm positioning itself directly beneath the one above. Then the segment flickered, faltered, and went out. The man known as Hugh was not impressed.
"A magic lantern. I've seen them in the Elven Kingdom."
"But what does it mean?"
asked the boy, staring, fascinated.
"Why does everything go around, then stop?"
Haplo was asking himself the same question. He had seen a magic lantern before. He had something similar to it on his ship, projecting images of the Nexus, only it had been devised by his lord and was much more sophisticated. It seemed to Haplo that there might be more pictures than what they were seeing, for the images stopped with an abrupt jerk in what looked to be mid-frame. There came a low whirring sound, and suddenly the pictures started over again. Alfred, whom Haplo took to be some sort of servant, started to reach out and grab the statue's hand, probably with the design of stopping the pictures.
"Please don't do that," said Haplo in his quiet voice.
Hugh whirled, sword drawn, and faced the intruder with an agility and skill that Haplo inwardly applauded. The nervous man crumpled to the floor, and the boy, turning, stared at the patron with blue eyes that were not frightened so much as shrewdly curious. Haplo stood with his hands up, palms outward. "I'm not armed," he said to Hugh. The patron wasn't the least afraid of the man's sword. There were no weapons in this world that could harm him, guarded as he was by the runes upon his body. But he must avoid the fight, for by that very act of protecting himself, he would reveal to knowing eyes who and what he truly was. "I don't mean anyone any harm." He smiled and shrugged, keeping his hands in the air and plainly visible. "I'm like the boy here. I only want to see the pictures." Of all of them, it was the child who intrigued Haplo. The cowardly servant, lying in a pathetic heap on the floor, did not merit his interest. The man he assumed to be a bodyguard he could dismiss now that he had noted his strength and agility. But when Haplo looked at the child, he felt a stinging sensation of the runes upon his chest, and knew by that sensation that some sort of enchantment was being cast at him. His own magic was instinctively acting to repel it, but Haplo was amused to note that whatever spell the child was casting wouldn't have worked anyway. His magic, whatever its source, had been disrupted.
"Where did you come from? Who are you?" demanded Hugh.
"My name is Haplo. My friends, the Geggs," he gestured to the hole out of which he'd come. Hearing a commotion behind him, he assumed that the ever-curious Limbeck was following. "And I heard of your coming and decided that we should meet and talk to you in private, if that's possible. Are the High Froman's guards around?" Hugh lowered the sword slightly, though his dark eyes continued to follow Haplo's every move.
"No, they left. But we're probably being watched."
"No doubt. And we haven't much time before someone returns." End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.
Limbeck, puffing and panting from his scramble up the ladder, trotted up behind Haplo. The Geg glanced askance at Hugh's sword, but his curiosity was stronger than his fear.
"Are you Mangers?" he asked, his gaze going from Haplo to the boy.
Haplo, watching Limbeck closely, saw an awed expression smooth out his face. The Geg's myopic eyes, magnified behind the spectacles, grew wide.
"You are a god, aren't you?"
"Yes," answered the child, speaking Geg. "I am a god."
"Do these speak human?"
asked Hugh, pointing to Limbeck, Jara, and the other two Geggs, who were cautiously poking their heads up out of the hole. Haplo shook his head.
"Then I can tell you the truth," said Hugh. "The kid's no more a god than you are."
To judge by the expression in Hugh's dark eyes, he had apparently reached the same decision about Haplo that Haplo had reached about Hugh. He was wary, cautious, suspicious still, but crowded inns force people to sleep with odd bedfellows or spend the night out in the cold.
"Our ship got caught in the maelstrom and crashed on Drevlin, not far from here. The Geggs found us and thought we were gods, and we had to play along."
"Like me," said Haplo, nodding.
He glanced down at the servant who had opened his eyes and was staring around him with an amused look.
"Who's that?"
"The kid's Chamberlain. I'm called Hugh the Hand. That's Alfred, and the kid's name is Bane, son of King Stephen of Volcaron and Ewelandia."
Haplo turned to Limbeck and Jara, who was staring at the three with deep suspicion, and made introductions. Alfred staggered to his feet and gazed at Haplo with a curiosity that deepened when he saw the man's rapt hands. Haplo, becoming aware of Alfred's stare, self-consciously tugged at the cloth.
"Are you injured, sir?" questioned the servant in respectful tones. "Forgive me for asking, but I notice the bandages you wear. I am somewhat skilled in healing." "Thank you, no. I'm not wounded. It's a skin disease, common to my people. It's not contagious, and it doesn't cause me any pain, but the pustules it creates aren't pleasant to look at."
Disgust twisted Hugh's features. Alfred's face paled slightly, and it was a struggle for the servant to express the proper sympathy. Haplo watched with inward satisfaction and did not believe he would encounter any further questions about his hands. Hugh sheathed his sword and drew near.
"Your ship crashed?" he asked Haplo in low tones.
"Yes."
"Destroyed?"
"Completely."
"Where are you from?"
"Down below, on one of the lower isles. You've probably never heard of it. Not many have. I was fighting a battle in my own lands when my ship was hit and I lost control."
Hugh walked toward the statue. Apparently deeply engrossed in the conversation, Haplo joined him, but managed to cast a casual glance back at the servant. Alfred's skin was a deathly hue, his eyes still staring intently at the patron's hands, as if the man wished desperately his look could pierce through the cloth.
"You're stranded down here, then?" asked Hugh.
Haplo nodded.
"And you want..."
Hugh hesitated, certain perhaps that he knew the answer, but wanting the other to say it.
"To get out," Haplo was emphatic.
Now it was Hugh who nodded. The two men understood each other completely. There was no trust between them, but that wasn't necessary, not as long as each was able to use the other to achieve a common goal. Bedfellows, it seemed, who wouldn't fight over the blankets. They continued to converse in low tones, considering their problem. Alfred stood staring at the man's hands. Bane, frowning, gazed after Haplo. The boy's fingers stroked the feather amulet. His thoughts were interrupted by the Geg.
"You're not a god, then?"
Drawn by an irresistible force, Limbeck had moved nearer to talk to the child.
"No,"
answered Bane, wrenching his gaze from Haplo. Turning to the Geg, the prince carefully and quickly smoothed his dour expression.
"I'm not, but they told me to tell that man, your king, that I was, so that he wouldn't hurt us.
Hurt you? Klimbeck appeared amazed. The concept was beyond him.
I'm really a prince of the high realm, continued the child. My father is a powerful wizard. We were going to see him when our ship crashed.
I'd dearly love to see the high realm, exclaimed Klimbeck. What's it like?
I'm not sure. You see, I've never been there before. I've lived all my life in the mid-realm with my adopted father. It's a long story.
I've never been to the mid-realm either, but I've seen pictures of it in a book I found on a Welf ship. I'll tell you how I found it.
Klimbeck began to recite his favorite tale, that of stumbling across the elven vessel. Bane, fidgeting, craned his neck to look back at Haplo and Hugh, standing together before the statue of the Manger. Alfred was muttering to himself. None of them was paying any attention to Jara. She didn't like this, any of it. She didn't like the two tall, strong gods putting their heads together and talking in a language she couldn't understand. She didn't like the way Klimbeck was looking at the child god. She didn't like the way the child god was looking at anyone. She didn't even like the way the tall, gawky god had tumbled down onto the floor. Jara had the feeling that, like poor relatives coming to visit, these gods were going to devour all the food, and when that was gone, leave the Geggs with nothing but an empty cupboard. Jara slipped over to where the two Geggs were standing nervously beside the hole.
Bring up everybody, she said in as soft a voice as is possible for a Gegg. The High Fromans tried to fool us with sham gods. We're going to capture them and take them before the people and prove that the High Froman is a fraud.
The Geggs looked at the so-called gods, then at each other. These gods didn't appear very impressive. Tall, maybe, but skinny. One of them carried a formidable-looking weapon. If he were mobbed, he wouldn't get a chance to use it. Haplo had mourned the extinction of Geg courage. It hadn't completely died out. It had just been buried under centuries of submission and toil. Now the coals had been stirred up. Here and there, flames were flickering. The excited Geggs backed down the ladder. Jara leaned over and looked down after them. Her square face, dimly illuminated by the glimmer lamps, was awesome, almost ethereal, when viewed from below. More than one Geg had a sudden image of ancient days, when the clan priestesses would have summoned them to war. Noisily, but in the disciplined manner the Geggs had learned serving the great machine, they clambered up the ladder. But with the thumping and the thumping going on all around, no one heard them. Forgotten in the confusion, Haplo's dog lay at the foot of the ladder. Nose on paws, it watched and listened, and seemed to ponder whether its master had really been serious about that word, stay. Chapter 35. Wom, Grevlin, Low Realm. Haplo heard a whine, felt a pawing at his leg. He turned his attention from examining the Manger pictures to look down at his feet.
What is it, boy? I thought I told you to...
Oh. The patron glanced over and saw the Geg streaming up out of the hole. The hand, hearing a sound at his back, looked in the opposite direction, toward the main entrance of the factory.
Company, said Hugh, the High Froman and his guards.
And over there. Hugh glanced swiftly toward the hole, his hand going to his sword. Haplo shook his head. No, we can't fight. There are too many. Besides, they don't want to harm us. They want to claim us. We're the prize. There's no time to explain. It looks as if we're going to be caught in the middle of a riot. You better go take care of that prince of yours.
He's an investment, began Hugh.
The coppers, Jara shrieked, catching sight of the High Froman. Quick, grab the guards before they stop us. Then you better go guard your investment, suggested Haplo.
What is it, sir?
Gasped Alfred, seeing Hugh running toward them, sword in hand. The two groups of Geggs were yelling and shaking their fists and snatching up makeshift weapons off the factory floor.
Trouble. Take the kid and go with...
Hugh began.
No, damn it, don't faint!
Alfred's eyes rolled back in his head. Hugh reached out to shake him or slap him or something, but it was too late. The Chamberlain's limp body slid down and flopped gracelessly across the feet of the Manger's statue. The Geggs rushed toward the gods. The High Froman, instantly recognizing his danger, ordered the coppers to rush the Geggs. Shouting wildly, some for the Whuppers and some for the Froman, the two groups came together. For the first time in the history of Drevlin, blows were struck, blood was shed. Haplo, gathering up his dog in his arms, melted back into the shadows and watched quietly, smiling. Jara stood near the hole, helping Geggs climb out, rallying her people to attack. When the last Geg was up out of the tunnels, she looked around and discovered that the battle had surged ahead of her. Worse, she had completely lost sight of Klimbeck, Haplo, and the three strange beings. Leaping onto the top of a crate, Jara peered over the heads of the milling, fighting press of Geggs, and saw, to her horror, the High Froman and the head clerk standing near the statue of the Manger, taking advantage of the confusion to spirit away not only the gods,
but also the august leader of WAP. Furious, Jara jumped from her crate and ran toward them, but got caught up in the midst of the battle. Pushing and shoving and lashing out with her fists at the Geggs blocking her path, she struggled to get near the statue. She was flushed and panting, her trousers were torn, her hair had fallen down over her face, and one eye was swelling shut when she finally reached her destination. The gods were gone, Limbeck was gone. The High Froman had won. Her fist doubled, Jara was prepared to punch the head of the first copper who came near her when she heard a moan, and looking down saw two large feet sticking up in the air. They weren't Geg feet, they were god feet. Hurrying around to the front of the manger, Jara was amazed to see the base of the statue standing wide open. One of the Froman's gods, the tall, gawky one, had apparently fallen into this opening and was lying half in and half out of it.
"I'm in luck," said Jara. "I've got this one at least."
She glanced fearfully behind her, expecting to see the Froman's coppers, but in the confusion and turmoil, no one was paying any attention to her. The Froman would be intent on getting his gods out of danger, and undoubtedly no one had missed this one yet.
"But they will. We have to get you away from here," muttered Jara.
Hurrying over to the god, she saw that he was lying on a staircase that led inside the statue. Descending below the floor level, the stairs provided a quick and easy means of escape. Jara hesitated. She was violating the statue, the Geg's most holy of holies. She had no idea why this opening was here or where it might lead. It didn't matter. This was only going to be a hiding place. She'd wait inside here until everyone was gone. Jara bounded over the comatose god and stumbled down the stairs. Turning, she grabbed the god's shoulders and dragged him, bumping and sliding and groaning, inside the statue. Jara had no clear plan in mind. She only hoped that by the time the High Froman came looking for this god and discovered the opening in the statue, she would have been able to smuggle him back to WAP headquarters. But when Jara drew the god's feet over the base, the opening suddenly and silently slid shut. The Geg found herself in darkness. Jara held perfectly still and tried to tell herself everything was all right, but panic was swelling up inside her until it seemed she must split apart. Her terror wasn't caused by fear of the dark. Living nearly all of their lives inside the Kixiwinsy, the Geggs were used to the darkness. Jara shook all over. Her hands were sweating, her breath came fast, her heart pounded, and she didn't know why. And then it came to her. It was quiet. She couldn't hear the machine, couldn't hear the comforting whistles and bangs and hammerings that had lulled her to sleep as a babe. Now there was nothing but awful, terrible silence. Sight is a sense outside and apart from the body, an image on the surface of the eye. But sound enters the ears, the head. It lives inside. In sound's absence, silence echoes. Abandoning the god on the staircase, heedless of pain, forgetting her fear of the coppers, Jara flung herself against the statue. "Help!" she screamed. "Help me!" Alfred regained consciousness. Sitting up, he accidentally began to slide down the stairs, and only saved himself by reflexively grabbing and hanging onto the steps beneath. Thoroughly confused, surrounded by pitch-black night with a Geg screaming like a steam whistle in his ears, Alfred endeavored to ask several times what was going on. The Geg paid no attention to him. Finally, crawling on hands and knees in the darkness back up the stairs, he reached out a hand in the direction of the nearly hysterical Jara.
"Where are we?"
She pounded and shrieked and ignored him.
"Where are we?"
Alfred caught hold of the Geg in his large hands, uncertain in the darkness just what part he'd grabbed, and began to shake her.
"Stop this! It isn't helping! Tell me where we are and maybe I can get us out of here!"
Not clearly understanding Alfred's words, but angered at his rough handling, Jara came to herself with a gulp and shoved the Chamberlain away with a heave of her strong arms. He slid and slithered and nearly tumbled back down the stairs, but managed to stop his fall.
"Now listen to me,"
Alfred said, separating each word and speaking it slowly and distinctly.
"Tell me where we are, and maybe I can help get us out." "I don't know how."
Breathing hard, shivering, Jara huddled as far away from Alfred as possible on the opposite side of the staircase.
"You're a stranger here. What could you know?"
"Just tell me," pleaded Alfred. "I can't explain. After all, what will it hurt?"
"Well," Jara considered, "we're inside the statue."
"Ah," breathed Alfred.
"What does ah mean?"
"It means, I thought that might be the case."
"Can you open it back up?"
"No, I can't. No one can. Not from the inside. But how would I know that if I've never been here before? What do I tell her?" Alfred was thankful for the darkness. He was a terrible liar, and it made it easier that he couldn't see her face and that she couldn't see his.
"I'm not certain, but I doubt it. You see, what is your name?"
"It doesn't matter."
"Yes, it does. We're here together in the dark, and we should know each other's names. Mine is Alfred, and yours?
Jara. Go on. You opened it once. Why can't you open it again?
I didn't open it, stammered Alfred. It opened by accident, I guess. You see, I have this terrible habit. Whenever I'm frightened, I faint. It's something I can't control. I saw the fighting, you see, and some of your people were rushing toward us, and I just passed out.
That much was true. What followed wasn't.
I guess that when I fell, I must have tripped something on the statue that caused it to open.
I regained consciousness. I looked up to see the statue, and I felt for the first time in a long, long while safe and secure and deeply, fervently at peace. The suspicion that had been awakened in my mind, the responsibility, the decisions I will be forced to make if that suspicion is true, overwhelmed me. I longed to escape, to disappear, and my hand moved of its own volition, without my prompting, and touched the statue's robe in a certain place, in a certain way. The base slid open, but then the enormity of my action must have been too much for me. I suppose I fainted again. The Geg came upon me, and, seeking a haven from the melee raging outside, dragged me in here. The base closed automatically, and it will stay closed. Only those who know the way in know the way out. Anyone stumbling across an entrance by mistake would never return to tell of it. Oh, they wouldn't die. The magic, the machine would care for them, and care for them very well, but they would be prisoners for the rest of their lives. Fortunately, I know the way in, I know the way out. But how can I explain this to the Geg?
A terrible thought occurred to Alfred. By law, he should leave her here. It was her own fault, after all. She shouldn't have entered the sacred statue. But then Alfred considered, with a pang of conscience, that perhaps she had endangered herself for him, trying to save his life. He couldn't just abandon her. He knew he couldn't, no matter what the law said. But right now it was all so confusing. If only he hadn't given way to his weakness.
Don't stop, Jara clutched at him.
Stop what?
Talking. It's the quiet. I can't stand listening to it. Why can't we hear anything in here?
It was made that way purposely, said Alfred with a sigh. Designed to offer rest and sanctuary. He had reached a decision. It probably wasn't the right one, but then he'd made few right decisions in his lifetime. I'm going to lead us out of here, Jara.
You know the way?
Yes.
How?
She was deeply suspicious.
I can't explain it. In fact, you will see many things that you won't understand and that I can't explain. I can't even ask you to trust me, because of course you don't, and I can't expect you to.
Pausing, Alfred considered his next words.
Let's look at it like this. You can't get out this way. You've tried. You can either stay here or you can come with me and I'll show you the way out.
Alfred heard the Geg draw breath to speak, but he forestalled her.
There's one more thing you should consider. I want to return to my people just as desperately as you want to go back to yours. The child you saw is in my care, and the dark man with him needs me, although he doesn't know it.
Alfred was silent a moment, thinking of the other man, the one who called himself Haplo, and it occurred to him that the silence was loud in here, louder than he'd remembered.
I'll go with you, said Jara. What you say makes sense.
Thank you, answered Alfred gravely. Now hold still one moment. This stairway is steep and dangerous without light. Alfred reached out his hand and felt the wall behind him. It was made of stone, like the tunnels, and was smooth and even. Running his hand along the surface, he had nearly reached the juncture where the wall met the stairs, when his fingers brushed over lines and whorls and notches carved in the stone. They formed a distinct pattern, one that he knew. Tracing his finger over the rough edges of the carving, following the lines of the pattern he could see clearly in his mind, he spoke the rune. The sigil beneath his fingers began to glow with a soft, radiant blue light. Jara, seeing it, caught her breath and sank backward, pressing herself against the wall. Alfred gave her a soothing, reassuring pat on the arm and repeated the rune. A sigil carved beside and touching the first caught the magical fire and began to glow. Soon, one after the other, a line of runes appeared out of the darkness, running the length of the steep staircase. At the bottom, they curved around a corner leading to the right. Now it's safe for us to go down, said Alfred, rising and brushing the dust of ages from his clothes. Keeping his words and actions purposefully brisk, his tone matter-of-fact, he held out his hand to Jara. If I might be of assistance? Jara hesitated, gulped, and hugged her shawl closely around her. Then, pressing her lips together, her face grim, she rested her small, work-worn hand in Alfred's. The blue-glowing runes glittered brightly in her fearful eyes. They descended the stairs swiftly, the runes making it easy to see the way. Hugh would not have recognized the bumbling, stumble-footed chamberlain. Alfred's movements were sure-footed, his stance erect. He hurried ahead with an anticipation that was eager, yet wistful and tinged with melancholy.
Reaching the bottom of the steep staircase, they found that it opened into a small, narrow corridor. A veritable honeycomb of doorways and tunnels branched off it in countless directions. The blue runes led them out of the corridor and into a tunnel, third from their right. Alfred followed the Sigler unhesitatingly, bringing with him a wide-eyed and awestruck Jara. At first, the Geg had doubted the man's words. She had lived among the delvings and burrowings of the Kixi-Winzi all her life. Gegs have a keen eye for minute detail and excellent memories. What looks to be a blank wall to a human or an elf holds a myriad of individual characteristics, cracks, crevices, chipped paint, for a Geg, and once seen is not soon forgotten. Consequently, Gegs do not easily lose themselves, either above ground or below. But Jara was almost instantly lost in these tunnels. The walls were flawless, perfect, and completely devoid of the life that a Geg can find, even in stone. And though the tunnels branched out in all directions, they did not turn and twist or ramble. There was no indication anywhere that a tunnel had been built just for the hell of it, out of a sense of adventure. The corridors ran straight and smooth, and gave the impression that wherever you were going, they'd get you there the quickest route possible, and no nonsense. Jara recognized in the design a sense of strong purpose, a calculated intent that frightened her by its sterility. Yet her strange companion seemed to find it comforting, and his confidence eased her fear. The runes led them in a gentle curve that kept taking them to their right. Jara had no idea how far they traveled, for there was no feeling of time down here. The blue Sigler ran on before them, lighting their path, each flaming to life out of the darkness as they neared it. Jara became mesmerized by them. It seemed as if she walked in a dream and might have kept walking forever as long as the runes led the way. The man's voice added to this eerie impression, for, as she had asked, he talked the entire time. Then, suddenly, they rounded a corner and Jara saw the Sigler climb into the air, form a glowing archway that burned and glistened in the darkness, inviting them to enter. Alfred paused. "What is it?" Jara asked, starting out of her trance, blinking and tightening her grip on Alfred's hand. "I don't want to go in there." "We have no choice. It's all right," said Alfred, and there was that note of wistful melancholy in his voice. "I'm sorry I frightened you. I'm not stopping because I'm afraid. I know what's in there, you see, and it only makes me sad, that's all." "We'll go back," said Jara suddenly, fiercely. She turned and took a step, but almost immediately the runes that had showed the way behind them flared a bright blue, then slowly began to fade. Soon the two were surrounded by darkness, the only light coming from flickering blue Sigler outlining the archway. "We can go in now," said Alfred, drawing a deep breath. "I'm ready. Don't be frightened, Jara," he added, patting her hand. "Don't be frightened by anything you see. Nothing can harm you." But Jara was frightened, though she couldn't say of what. Whatever lay beyond was hidden in darkness, yet what frightened her wasn't a fear of bodily harm or the terror of the unknown. It was the sadness, as Alfred had said. Perhaps it had come from the words he'd been speaking during their long walk, although she was so disoriented and confused that she could recall nothing of what he'd said. But she experienced a feeling of despair, of overwhelming regret, of something lost and never found, never even sought. The sorrow made her ache with loneliness, as if everything and everyone she had ever known was suddenly gone. Tears came to her eyes, and she wept, and she had no idea for whom she was crying. "It's all right," repeated Alfred. "It's all right. Shall we go in now? Do you feel up to it?" Jara couldn't answer, couldn't stop crying. But she nodded, and weeping, clinging closely to Alfred, walked with him through the archway. And then Jara understood, in part, the reason for her fear and her sadness. She stood in a mausoleum. Chapter 36. Wome, Grevelin, Low Realm.
"This is dreadful, simply dreadful, unheard of. What are you going to do? What are you going to do?"
The head clerk was clearly becoming hysterical. Darrell Longshoreman felt a tingling in his hands and was hard-pressed to resist the temptation to administer a right to the jaw.
"There's been enough bloodshed already," he muttered, grasping hold of his hands firmly behind his back in case they took it upon themselves to act on their own. And he managed to ignore the voice that whispered, "A little more blood wouldn't hurt then, would it?"
Decking his brother-in-law, though undoubtedly very satisfying, wasn't going to solve his problems.
"Get hold of yourself," Darrell snapped. "Haven't I got trouble enough?"
"Never has blood been spilled in Drevlin," cried the head clerk in an awful tone. "It's all the fault of this evil genius Limbeck. He must be cast forth, made to walk the steps of Terrelfen. The Mangers must judge him."
"Oh, shut up. That's what brought on all this trouble in the first place. We gave him to the Mangers, and what did they do? Gave him right back to us, and threw in a guard. Sure, we'll send Limbeck down the steps."
Darrell waved his arms wildly.
Maybe this time he'll come up with a whole army of gods and destroy us all.
But that god of Limbeck's isn't a god, protested the head clerk.
They're none of them gods, if you ask me, stated Darrow Longshoreman.
Not even the child?
This question, asked in wistful tones by the head clerk, posed a problem for Darrow. When he was in Bane's presence, he felt that, yes, indeed, he had at last discovered a god. But the moment he could no longer see the blue eyes and the pretty face and the sweetly curved lips of the little boy, the High Froman seemed to waken from a dream. The kid was a kid, and he, Darrow Longshoreman, was a sap for ever thinking otherwise.
No, said the High Froman, not even the child.
The two rulers of Drevlin were alone in the factory, standing beneath the statue of the Manger, gloomily surveying the battlefield. It hadn't in reality been much of a battle. One might hardly even term it a skirmish. The aforesaid blood had flowed not from the heart, but from several cracked heads, gushed out a few smashed noses. The head clerk had sustained a bump, the High Froman a jammed thumb that had swelled up and was now turning several quite remarkable colors. No one had been killed. No one had even been seriously injured. The habit of living peacefully over numerous centuries is a hard one to break, but Darrell Longshoreman, High Froman of his people, was wise enough to know that this was only the beginning. A poison had entered the collective body of the Geggs, and though the body might survive, it would never be healthy again.
Besides, said Darrell, his heavy brows creased in a scowl, if these gods aren't gods, like Limbeck said they weren't, how can we punish him for being right?
Unaccustomed to wading in such deep philosophical waters, the head clerk ignored the question and struck out for high ground.
We wouldn't be punishing him for being right. We'd be punishing him for spreading it around.
There was certainly some logic to that, Darrell had to admit. He wondered sourly how his brother-in-law had come up with such a good idea, and concluded it must have been the bump on the head. Wringing his wounded thumb and wishing he was back home in his holding tank with Mrs. High Froman clucking over him and bringing him a soothing cup of bark warm, Darrell pondered the idea, born of desperation, that was lurking about in the dark alleys of his mind. Footnote. Bark warm. A hot drink concocted by boiling the bark from a furbin bush in water for about half an hour. To elves, the drink is mildly narcotic, acting as a sedative, but to humans and dwarves, it merely brings on a feeling of restful relaxation. End of footnote.
Maybe this time, when we throw him off the steps of Terrell Fen, we can leave off the kite, suggested the head clerk. I always did think that was an unfair advantage.
No, said Darrow, the rattle-brained ideas of his brother-in-law making his decision for him. I'm not sending him or anyone else down anymore. Down isn't safe, seemingly. This god that isn't a god of Limbeck says he comes from down, and therefore...
The High Froman paused during a particularly loud spate of banging and whanging from the Kixie-Winsie.
I'm going to send him up.
Up?
The bump on the head was not going to come to the aid of the head clerk on this one. He was absolutely and categorically lost.
I'm going to turn the gods over to the wells, said Darrell Longshoreman with dark satisfaction.
The High Froman paid a visit to the prison vat to announce the captive's punishment, an announcement he reckoned must strike terror into their guilty hearts. If it did, the prisoners gave no outward sign. Hugh appeared disdainful, Bane bored, and Haplow impassive, while Limbeck was in such misery that it was doubtful if he heard the High Froman at all. Getting nothing from his prisoners but fixed cold stares, and in Bane's case a yawn and a sleepy smile, the High Froman marched out in high dudgeon.
I presume you know what he's talking about, inquired Haplow. This being given to the wells?
Elves, corrected the hand. Once a month, the elves come down on a transport ship and pick up a supply of water. This time they'll pick us up with it, and we don't want to end up prisoners of the elves. Not if they catch us down here with their precious water supply. Those bastards can make dying very unpleasant.
The captives were locked up in the local prison, a grouping of storage vats that the Kixie-Winsie had abandoned and which, when fitted with locks on the doors, made excellent cells. Generally, the cells were little used, perhaps the occasional thief or a geg who had been lax in his service to the great machine. Due to the current civil unrest, however, the vats were filled to capacity with disturbers of the peace. One vat had to be emptied of its inhabitants in order to make room for the gods. The geg prisoners were crowded into another vat so as to avoid being placed in contact with Mad Limbeck. The vat was steep-walled and solid. Several openings covered with iron grills dotted the sides. Hugh and Haplow investigated these grills and discovered that fresh air, smelling damply of rain, was flowing in through them, leading the men to assume the grills covered shafts that must eventually connect with the outside. The shafts might have offered a means of escape, except for two drawbacks. First, the grills were bolted to the metal sides of the vat.
And second, no one in his right mind wanted to go outside.
So you're suggesting we fight? Inquired Haplo. I presume these elven ships are well manned. We have four, counting the Chamberlain, plus a child and one sword between us. A sword that's currently in the possession of the guards.
The Chamberlain's worthless, grunted Hugh. Leaning back comfortably against the brick wall of their prison, he drew out his pipe and stuck the stem between his teeth. The first sign of danger and he faints dead away. You saw him back there during the riot.
That's odd, isn't it?
He's odd, stated Hugh.
Haplo could remember Alfred's eyes trying desperately to pierce the cloth covering the patron's hands, almost as if the Chamberlain knew what was beneath.
I wonder where he got to. Did you see?
Hugh shook his head. All I saw was Geggs. I had the kid. But the Chamberlain's bound to turn up, or rather stumble up. He won't leave his highness.
The hand nodded at Bane, who was talking away at the misery-stricken Limbeck. Haplo followed Hugh's gaze and focused on the Geg.
There's always Limbeck and his wops. They'd fight to save us, or if not us, their leader.
Hugh glanced at him dubiously.
Do you think so? I always heard Geggs had the fighting spirit of a flock of sheep.
That may be true now, but it didn't used to be so. Not in the old days.
Once long ago, the dwarves were a fierce, proud people. Hugh, returning his gaze to Limbeck, shook his head. The Geg sat huddled in a corner, his shoulders slumped, arms dangling limply between his knees. The child was talking at him. The Geg was completely oblivious of the conversation.
He's been walking along with his head in the clouds, said Haplo. He didn't see the ground coming and got hurt in the fall, but he's the one to lead his people.
You're really caught up in this revolution of theirs, observed Hugh. Some might wonder why you care.
Limbeck saved my life, answered Haplo, lazily scratching the ears of the dog that was stretched out at his side, its head resting in his lap.
I like him and his people. As I said, I know something about their past.
The mild face darkened.
I hate seeing what they've become. Sheep, I believe, was how you put it.
Hugh sucked thoughtfully, silently, on his empty pipe. The man sounded good, but Hugh found it difficult to believe this Haplo was that concerned about a bunch of dwarves. A quiet, unassuming man, you tended to ignore him, forget he was around. And that, said Hugh to himself, might be a very big mistake. Lizards that blend in with the rocks do so to catch flies.
Somehow we've got to get some backbone into your Limbeck, then, remarked Hugh. If we're going to save ourselves from the elves, we'll need the Geggs to help us.
You can leave him to me, said Haplo. Where were you headed before you got caught up in all this?
I was going to return the kid to his father, his real father, the Mysteriarch.
Damn nice of you, commented Haplo.
Hugh grunted, his lips twisting in a grin.
These wizards who live in the High Realm, why was it they left the world below? They must have enjoyed a large amount of power among the people.
The answer to that depends on who you ask. The Mysteriarchs claim they left because they'd advanced in culture and wisdom and the rest of us hadn't. Our barbaric ways disgusted them. They didn't want to bring up their kids in an evil world.
And what do you barbarians say to all this? Asked Haplo, smiling.
The dog had rolled over on its back, all 4 feet in the air, its tongue lolling out of its mouth in foolish pleasure.
We say,
Hugh sucked on the empty pipe, his words coming out between the stem and his teeth,
that the Mysteriarchs were afraid of the growing power of the elven wizards and beat it. They left us in the lurch, no doubt of it. Their leaving was the cause of our downfall. If it hadn't been for the revolt among their own people, the elves would be our masters still.
And so these Mysteriarchs wouldn't be welcome if they returned.
Oh, they'd be welcome. Welcomed with cold steel if the people had their way. But our king maintains friendly relations, or so I've heard. People wonder why.
His gaze shifted back to Bane. Haplo knew the changeling's story. Bane himself had proudly explained it to him. But the Mysteriarchs could come back if one of them was the human king's son. Hugh made no response to the obvious. He removed the pipe from his mouth, tucked it back in his doublet. Crossing his arms over his chest, he rested his chin on his breast and closed his eyes. Haplo rose to his feet, stretched. He needed to walk, needed to work the kinks out of his muscles. Pacing the cell, the patron thought about all he'd heard. He had very little work to do, it seemed. This entire realm was overripe and ready to fall. His lord would not even have to reach out his hand to pluck it. The fruit would be found lying, rotting, on the ground at his feet. Surely this was the clearest possible evidence that the Sartan were no longer involved in the world? The child was the question. Bane had evinced a magical power, but that might be expected of the son of a Mysteriarch of the Seventh House. Long ago, before the Sundering, the magics of those wizards had reached the lower level of both Sartan and Patrons.
After all this time, they had likely grown in power. Orbain could be a young Sartan, clever enough not to reveal himself. Haplo looked over to where the boy sat talking earnestly to the distraught Geg. The patron made an almost imperceptible sign with his wrapped hand. The dog, who rarely took his eyes from his master, immediately trotted over to Limbeck and gave the Geg's limp hand a swipe with his tongue. Limbeck looked up and smiled wanly at the dog, who, tail wagging, settled down comfortably at the Geg's side. Haplo drifted over to the opposite end of the vat to stare in seeming absorption at one of the air shafts. He could now hear clearly every word being said.
"You can't give up," said the boy. "Not now. The fight's just beginning."
"But I never meant there to be a fight," protested poor Limbeck. "Gegs attacking each other. Nothing like that has ever happened before in our history, and it's all my fault."
"Oh, stop whining," said Bane.
Scratching at an itch on his stomach, he looked around the vat and frowned.
"I'm hungry. I wonder if they're going to starve us. I'll be glad when the wells get here. I..."
The boy fell suddenly silent, as if someone had bidden him hold his tongue. Haplo, glancing surreptitiously over his shoulder, saw Bane holding the feather amulet, rubbing it against his cheek. When he spoke again, his voice had changed.
"I've got an idea, Limbeck,"
said the prince, scooting forward to be very near the Geg.
"When we leave this place, you can go with us. You'll see how well the elves and the humans live up above while you Gegs slave down here below. Then you can come back and tell your people what you've seen, and they'll be furious. Even this king of yours will have to go along with you. My father and I will help you raise an army to attack the elves and the humans."
"An army? Attack?"
Limbeck stared at him, horrified, and Bane saw that he had gone too far.
"Never mind about that now," he said, brushing aside world warfare. "The important thing is that you get to see the truth."
"The truth," repeated Limbeck.
"Yes," said Bane,
sensing that the Geg was at last impressed.
"The truth. Isn't that what's important? You and your people can't go on living a lie." "Wait, I just got an idea. Tell me about this judgment that's supposed to come to the Gegs."
Limbeck appeared thoughtful, his misery fading. It was as if he'd put on his spectacles. Everything that was blurry he could now see clearly, see the sharp lines and crisp edges.
"When the judgment is given and we are found worthy, we will ascend to the realms above."
"This is it, Limbeck," said Bane, awed. "This is the judgment. It's all happened just like the prophecy said. We came down and found you worthy, and now you're going to ascend into the upper realms."
"Very clever, kid," said Haplo to himself. "Very clever." Bane no longer held the feather. Daddy was no longer prompting. That last had been Bane's own idea, seemingly. A remarkable child, this changeling, and a dangerous one.
"But we thought the judgment would be peaceful."
"Was that ever said?" Bane countered. "Anywhere in the prophecy?"
Limbeck turned his attention to the dog, patting its head, attempting to avoid answering while he tried to accustom himself to this new vision.
"Limbeck?" pushed Bane.
The Geg continued to stroke the dog, who lay still beneath his hands.
"New vision," he said, looking up. "That's it. When the wells come, I know just what to do."
"What?"
asked Bane eagerly.
"I'll make a speech."
Later that evening, after their jailers brought them food, Hugh called a meeting.
"We don't want to end up prisoners of the elves," explained the assassin. "We've got to fight and try to get away. And we can, if you Gegs will help us."
Limbeck wasn't listening. He was composing.
"Wells and wops, wadies and gentle. No, no, too many was. Distinguished visitors from another realm. That's better. Drat, I wish I could write this down."
The Geg paced up and down in front of his companions, mulling over his speech and pulling distractedly on his beard. The dog, trotting along behind him, looked sympathetic and wagged its tail. Haplo shook his head.
"Don't look for help there."
"But, Limbeck, it wouldn't be much of a battle," Bane protested. "The Gegs outnumber the elves. We'll take them completely by surprise. I don't like elves. They threw me off their ship. I nearly died."
"Distinguished visitors from another realm,"
Haplo pursued his argument. "The Gegs are untrained, undisciplined. They don't have any weapons. And even if they could get weapons, we don't dare trust them. It'd be like sending in an army of children, ordinary children." Haplo added, seeing Bane bristle.
"The Gegs aren't ready yet."
He put an unconscious emphasis on the word that caught Hugh's attention.
"Yet."
"When Father and I return," struck in Bane, "we're going to whip the Gegs into shape. We'll take on the elves and we'll win. Then we'll control all the water in the world and we'll have power and be rich beyond belief."
"Rich." Hugh twisted his beard.
A thought occurred to him. If it came to open war, any human with a ship and the nerve to fly the maelstrom could make his fortune in one run. He would need a watership, an elven watership and a crew to man it. It would be a shame to destroy these elves.
What about the Geggs? Suggested Haplo. Oh, we'll take care of them, answered Bane. They'll have to fight a lot harder than what I've seen so far, but...
Fight, repeated Hugh, interrupting Bane in mid-dictatorship. Why are we talking about fighting?
Reaching into his pocket, he drew forth his pipe and clamped his teeth down on it.
How are you at singing? He asked Haplo.
Chapter 37. The Resting Place, Low Realm. Jara's hand slid nervelessly from Alfred's. She could not move. The strength seeped from her body. She shrank back against the archway, leaning on it for support. Alfred never seemed to notice. He walked ahead, leaving the Geg, shaken and trembling, to wait for him. The chamber he entered was vast. Jara couldn't recall ever seeing such a huge open space in her life, a space not inhabited by some whirly, clanging, or thumping part of the Kixiwinsy. Made of the same smooth, flawless stone as the tunnels, the walls of the chamber glowed with a soft white light that began to shine from them when Alfred set his foot inside the archway. It was by this light that Jara saw the coffins. Set into the walls, each covered by glass, the coffins numbered in the hundreds and held the bodies of men and women. Jara could not see the people closely. They were little more than silhouettes against the light. But she could tell that they were of the same race as Alfred and the other gods who had come to Drevlin. The bodies were tall and slender and lay resting with arms at their sides. The floor of the chamber was smooth and wide, and the coffins encircled it in rows that extended up to the high domed ceiling. The chamber itself was completely empty. Alfred moved slowly, looking all around him in wistful recognition, as does someone returning home after a long absence. The light in the room grew brighter, and Jara saw that there were symbols on the floor, similar in shape and design to the runes that had lit their way. There were 12 sigla, each carved singular and alone, never touching or overlapping. Alfred moved carefully among these, his gangly, ungainly form weaving its way across the empty chamber in a solemn dance, the lines and movements of his body appearing to imitate the particular sigil over which he was passing. He made a complete circuit of the chamber, drifting across the floor, dancing to silent music. He glided close to each rune, but never touched it, gliding away to another, honoring each in turn, until finally he came to the center of the chamber. Kneeling, he placed his hands upon the floor and began to sing. Jara could not understand the words he sang, but the song filled her with a joy that was bittersweet, because it did nothing to lighten the terrible sadness. The runes on the floor glittered brightly, almost blinding in their radiance during Alfred's song. When he ceased, their gleaming light began to fade, and within moments was gone. Alfred, standing in the center, sighed. The body that had moved so beautifully in the dance stooped, the shoulders rounded. He looked over at Jara and gave her a wistful smile. "You're not still frightened." He made a weak gesture toward the rows of coffins. Nobody here can harm you, not any more. Not that they would have anyway, at least not intentionally. He sighed, and turning in his place, looked long around the room. But how much harm have we done, unintentionally, meaning the best? Not gods, but with the power of gods, and yet lacking the wisdom. He walked slowly and with head bowed over to a row of coffins that stood very near the entrance, near Jara. Alfred placed his hand on one of the crystal windows, his fingers stroking it with an almost caressing touch. Sighing, he rested his forehead against another coffin up above. Jara saw that the coffin he touched was empty. The others around it held bodies in them, and she noticed, her attention called to these because of him, that they seemed all to be young. Younger than he is, she thought, her gaze going to the bald head, the domed forehead, carved with lines and anxiety, worry and care that were so pronounced a smile only deepened them. "These are my friends," he said to Jara. "I told you about them as we were coming down here." He smoothed the crystal closure with one hand. "I told you that they might not be here. I told you that they might have gone. But I knew in my heart what I told you wasn't true. They would be here. They will be here forever. Because they're dead, you see, Jara. Dead before their time. I am alive long after." He closed his eyes, then covered his face with his hand. A sob wrenched the tall, ungainly body that leaned against the coffins. Jara didn't understand. She hadn't listened to anything about these friends, and she could not and did not want to think about what she was seeing. But the man was grieving, and his grief was heartbreaking to witness. Looking at the young people with their beautiful faces, serene and unmarred and cold as the crystal behind which they lay, Jara understood that Alfred did not grieve for one, but for many, himself among them. Wrenching herself from the archway, she crept forward and slipped her hand into his. The solemnity, the despair, the sorrow of the place and of this man had affected Jara deeply. Just how deeply she would not come to know until much later in her life. During that future time of great crisis when it seemed to her that she was losing all that was most valuable to her, everything he said, the story of Alfred and his losses and those of his people, would come back to her. "Alfred, I'm sorry." The man looked down at her, the tears glistening on his eyelashes. Squeezing her hand, he said something that she did not understand, for it was not in her language, nor in any other language that had been spoken for long ages in the realm of Arianus. "This is why we failed," he said in that ancient language. "We thought of the many and forgot the one. And so I am alone, and left perhaps to face by myself a peril ages old." The man with the bandaged hands, he shook his head. "The man with the bandaged hands." He left the mausoleum without looking back. No longer afraid, Jara walked with him. Hugh woke at the sound. Starting up, pulling his dagger from his boot, he was on the move before he had completely thrown off sleep. It took him but an instant to collect himself, his eyes blinking back the blur of waking, adjusting to the dim glow of glimmer lamps shining from the never-sleeping Kixie-Winsie. There was the sound again. He was heading in the right direction. It had come from behind one of the grills located on the side of the vat. Hugh's hearing was acute, his reflexes quick. He had trained himself to sleep lightly, and he was therefore not pleased to discover Haplow, fully awake, calmly standing near the air shaft as if he'd been there for hours. The sounds, scuffling and scraping, could now be heard clearly. They were getting closer. The dog, fur bristling around its neck, stared up at the shaft and whined softly. "Shht!" Haplow hissed, and the dog quieted. It walked around in a nervous circle and came back to stand beneath the shaft again. Seeing Hugh, Haplow made a motion with his hand. "Cover that side." Hugh did not hesitate, but obeyed the silent command. To argue about leadership now would have been foolhardy. With some unknown something creeping toward them in the night, and the two of them with only their bare hands and one dagger to fight it. He reflected as he took up his stance that not only had Haplow heard and reacted to the sound, he had moved so softly and stealthily that Hugh, who had heard the sound, had not heard Haplow. The scuffling grew louder, nearer. The dog stiffened and bared its teeth. Suddenly, there came a thump and a muffled, "Ouch!" Hugh relaxed.
"It's Alfred."
"How in the name of the Mangers did he find us?" Haplow muttered, a white face pressed against the grillwork from the inside.
"Sir Hugh, he has a wide range of talents," remarked Hugh.
"I'd be interested in hearing about them," returned Haplow. "How do we get him out?" He peered inside the grillwork. "Who's that with you?"
"One of the Geggs. Her name's Jara."
The Geg poked her head beneath Alfred's arm. The space they were in was seemingly a tight fit, and Alfred was forced to scrunch up until he practically doubled in two to make room.
"Where's Limbeck?" Jara demanded. "Is he all right?"
"He's over there, asleep. The grill's bolted fast on this side, Alfred. Can you work any of the bolts out from yours?"
"I'll see, sir. It's rather difficult without any light. Perhaps if I used my feet, sir, and kicked..."
"Good idea." Haplow backed out of the way, the dog trotting at his heels.
"It's about time his feet were good for something," said Hugh, moving to the side of the vat. "It's going to make one hell of a clatter."
"Fortunately, the machine's doing an excellent job of clattering itself. Stand back, dog."
"I want to see Limbeck."
"In just a moment, Jara," came Alfred's mollifying voice. "Now, if you'll just scoot over there and give me some room..."
Hugh heard a thud and saw the grillwork shiver slightly. Two more kicks, a groan from Alfred, and the grill popped off the side of the vat and fell to the ground. By now, Limbeck and Bane were both awake and had come over to stare curiously at their midnight callers. Jara slid out feet first. Landing on the floor of the vat, she raced to Limbeck, threw her arms around him, and hugged him tight.
"Oh, my dear," she said in a fierce whisper, "you can't imagine where I've been. You can't imagine it."
Limbeck, feeling her trembling in his arms, somewhat bewilderedly smoothed her hair and gingerly patted her on the back. "But never mind," said Jara, returning to the serious business at hand. "The news singers say the High Froman's going to turn you over to the Wells. Don't worry. We're going to get you out of here now. This air shaft Alfred found leads to the outskirts of the city. Where we'll go once we leave here, I'm not quite certain. But we can sneak out of Wome tonight and..."
"Are you all right, Alfred?"
Hugh offered to help extricate the Chamberlain from the shaft.
"Yes, sir."
Tumbling out of the air shaft, Alfred attempted to put his weight on his legs and crumpled over in a heap on the ground.
"That is, perhaps not," he amended from where he sat on the floor of the vat, a pained expression on his face.
I'm afraid I've damaged something, sir, but it's not serious. Standing on one foot with Hugh's help, he leaned back against the vat. I can walk. You couldn't walk when you had two good feet. It's nothing, sir. My knee. Guess what, Alfred, interrupted Bane. We're going to fight the elves. I beg your pardon, Your Highness.
We're not going to have to escape, Jara, Limbeck was explaining. At least I'm not. I'm going to make a speech to the Wells and ask for their help and cooperation. Then the Wells will fly us to the realms above. I'll see the truth, Jara. I'll see it for myself.
Make a speech to the Wells? Jara gasped, her breath completely taken away by this astounding revelation.
Yes, my dear, and you've got to spread the word among our people. We'll need their help. Haplo will tell you what to do.
You're not going to fight anyone, are you?
No, my dear, said Limbeck, stroking his beard. We're going to sing.
Sing?
Jara stared from one to another in blank astonishment.
I don't know much about elves. Are they fond of music?
What did she say? Hugh demanded. Alfred, we've got to get this plan moving. Come here and translate for me. I have to teach her that song before morning.
Very well, sir, said Alfred. I assume, sir, you are referring to the song of the Battle of Seven Fields?
Yes. Tell her not to worry about what the words mean. They'll have to learn to sing it in human. Have her memorize it line by line and say it back to us to make sure she's got the words. The song shouldn't be too difficult for them to learn. Kids sing it all the time.
I'll help, Bane volunteered.
Haplo, squatting on the ground, stroked the dog, watched and listened, and said nothing. Jara, is that her name? Hugh approached the two Geggs, Bane dancing at his side. The man's face was dark and stern in the flickering light. Bane's blue eyes gleamed with excitement. Can you rally your people, teach them this song, and have them there at the ceremony? Alfred translated. This king of yours said the Wells will be here this day at noon. That doesn't give you much time.
Sing, Jara murmured, staring at Limbeck. Are you really going? Up there?
Taking off his spectacles, Limbeck rubbed them on his shirt sleeve and put them on again. Yes, my dear, if the Wells don't mind.
If the Wells don't mind, Alfred translated to Hugh, giving him a meaningful glance.
Don't worry about the Wells, Alfred, interposed Haplo. Limbeck's going to make a speech.
Oh, Limbeck. Jara was pale, biting her lip. Are you sure you should go up there? I don't think you should leave us. What will Wap do without you? You going off like that, it will seem like the High Froman's won.
Limbeck frowned. I hadn't thought about that. Removing his spectacles, he began to clean them again. Instead of putting them back on, he absent-mindedly stuck them in his pocket. He looked at Jara and blinked, as if wondering why she was all blurry.
I don't know. Perhaps you're right, my dear.
Hugh ground his teeth in frustration. He didn't know what had been said, but he could see the Geg was having second thoughts, and that was going to lose him his ship and probably his life. He looked impatiently at Alfred to help, but the Chamberlain, limping on one foot, appeared undignified and stork-like, also very sad and unhappy. Hugh was just admitting to himself that he might have to rely on Haplo when he saw the man, with a signal of his hand, send the dog forward. Gliding across the floor of the vat, the animal came to Limbeck and thrust its muzzle in the Geg's hand. Limbeck started at the unexpected touch of the cold nose and jerked his hand away. But the dog remained, looking up at him intently, the bushy tail slowly brushing from side to side. Limbeck's near-sighted gaze was drawn slowly and irresistibly from the dog to its master. Hugh glanced swiftly back at Haplo to see what message he was giving, but the man's face was mild and tranquil with that quiet smile. Limbeck's hand absently stroked the dog, his eyes fixed on Haplo. He sighed deeply.
My dear, Jara touched him on the arm.
The truth. And my speech. I must make my speech. I'm going, Jara. And I'm counting on you and our people to help. And when I come back, when I've seen the truth, then we'll start the revolution. Jara recognized his stubborn tone, knew it was hopeless to argue. She wasn't certain she wanted to argue anyway. Part of her was stirred at the thought of what Limbeck was doing. It was the beginning of the revolution, really and truly. But he would be leaving her. She hadn't realized until now how much she truly loved him.
I could come too, she offered.
No, my dear. Limbeck gazed at her fondly. It wouldn't do for both of us to be gone. He took a step forward, put his hands out to where it looked to his near-sighted eyes her shoulders were. Jara, used to this, moved up to be right where he thought she was. You must prepare the people for my return.
I'll do it.
The dog, afflicted by a sudden itch, sat down, scratching at its fur with a hind foot.
You can teach her the song now, sir, said Alfred.
Alfred translating, Hugh gave Jara his instructions, taught her the song, then bundled her back into the air shaft. Limbeck stood beneath it, and before she left, reached up to hold her hand.
Thank you, my dear. This will be for the best. I know it.
Yes, I know it, too.
To hide the trouble in her voice, Jara leaned down and gave Limbeck a shy kiss on the cheek. She waved her hand to Alfred, who gave her a small, solemn bow. Then she hastily turned and began to climb through the air shaft. Hugh and Haplo lifted the grill and put it back in place as best they could, hammering at it with their fists.
Are you hurt very badly, Alfred?
Asked Bane, struggling against sleepiness and an unwillingness to return to bed and possibly miss out on something.
No, Your Highness, thank you for asking.
Bane nodded and yawned.
I think I'll just lie down, Alfred.
Not to sleep, mind you, just to rest. Allow me to straighten your blankets, Your Highness.
Alfred cast a swift, sidelong glance over to Hugh and Haplo, pounding at the grill.
Might I trouble Your Highness with a question?
Bane yawned until his jaws cracked. Eyelids drooping, he plopped down on the floor of the vat and said sleepily,
Sure, Your Highness.
Alfred lowered his voice, keeping his eyes fixed on the blanket that he was, as usual, clumsily twisting and knotting and doing everything but straightening.
When you look at that man, Haplo, what do you see?
A man, not very good-looking, but not very ugly, not like you. That Haplo's not very much of anything, if you ask me. Here, you're making a mess of that, as usual.
No, Your Highness, I can manage.
The Chamberlain continued to maul the blanket.
About my question. That really wasn't what I meant, Your Highness.
Alfred paused, licking his lips. He knew that this next question would undoubtedly start Bane thinking. Yet Alfred felt at this juncture he had no choice. He had to know the truth.
What can you see with your special vision?
Bane's eyes widened, then narrowed, glistening with shrewdness and cunning. But the intelligence in them was gone so swiftly, masked by the bright gloss of innocence, that Alfred, if he had not seen it before, might not have believed he saw it then.
Why do you ask, Alfred? Just out of curiosity, Your Highness, nothing more.
Bane regarded him speculatively, perhaps gauging how much more information he was likely to wheedle from the Chamberlain, perhaps wondering whether he could gain more by telling the truth or lying, or a judicious mixture of both. Giving Haplo a wary sidelong glance, Bane leaned confidentially near to Alfred and said softly,
I can't see anything.
Alfred sat back on his heels, his careworn face drawn and troubled. He stared intently at Bane, trying to judge whether or not the child was sincere.
Yes,
continued Bane, taking the man's look for a question.
I can't see anything.
And there's only one other person I've met who's the same.
You, Alfred. What do you make of that?
The child gazed up at him with bright, shining eyes. The blanket suddenly seemed to spread itself out, smooth and flat, without a wrinkle.
You can lie down now, Your Highness. We have, it seems, an exciting day tomorrow.
I asked you a question, Alfred,
said the prince, stretching out obediently.
Yes, Your Highness.